This is Gil Manser welcoming you to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's guest is Karen Thompson Walker, whose debut novel, The Age of Miracles, is viewed through the eyes of a sixth-grade San Diego girl as the world everyone knew abruptly changes on a daily basis. Later in the show, we will be remembering Point Reyes author and environmentalist Philip Fradkin. His recent death prompted us to recall the word-by-word conversation we had in 2008 about his biography Wallace Stegner and the American West. To honor Philip Fradkin, we will be playing an excerpt from a speech Wallace Stegner gave in 1991 about becoming a writer. But first, let's visit with Karen Thompson Walker. Walker was born and raised in San Diego, California, and she uses this setting for The Age of Miracles. She studied English and creative writing at UCLA, where she wrote for the UCLA Daily Bruin. After college, she worked as a newspaper reporter in the San Diego area before moving to New York City to attend the Columbia University MFA program. A former book editor at Simon & Schuster, she wrote The Age of Miracles in the mornings before work, sometimes while riding the subway. She is the recipient of the 2011 Sirenland Fellowship, as well as a BOM Magazine Fiction Prize. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband. Karen, I want to welcome you to KRCB's Word by Word.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good. You just flew up from Los Angeles, which is, did you go home to San Diego when you were down there?
We did. For the weekend, we were in San Diego, did one event in San Diego, then went to L.A., and now we're here.
Were the tides coming in higher and higher? I'm giving away part of the book. Now, one of the things that I read about is something you said at the TED Global 2012. When read in the right way, our fears are an incredible gift of the imagination. I'm going to say that again. Our fears are an incredible gift of the imagination. Properly read, our fears are as precious as our favorite literature, and they can give us a little wisdom, some insight, and a vision of that most elusive thing, the truth. Now, that is your novel in a paragraph, because exactly that's what happened. There's certainly fear on a daily basis. So you want to tell us about the setup and the realities of being an 11-year-old girl as the world's changing around you?
It's true that it's a lot about fear and kind of learning to live with fear and uncertainty. So that certainly is a big part of the book. But it's the story of a young girl named Julia. She and her family wake up one day, along with the rest of the world, to some really extraordinary and alarming news. And the news is that the rotation of the Earth has suddenly started to slow down. So the book is really the story of that global catastrophe and how it gradually unfolds and how it affects, you know, the plants and the animals of the Earth. But it's also just as much a story about growing up. It's about Julia's life during that year in all the ways that it changes as a result of the slowing, but also a lot of the just ordinary disasters and the ordinary highs and lows of adolescence.
Sixth grader,
right.
So where did this idea come from?
I got the idea from something that really happened that I read about in a newspaper article back in 2004, shortly after the earthquake that caused the tsunami in Indonesia. I read that earthquake was so powerful that it also affected the rotation of the Earth by a slight amount.
Right. But minuscule.
Right. So after that, our 24-hour days were a few microseconds shorter than before. And when I read that, I was just really stunned. I found it really haunting. I didn't know that that was possible, that something that I had always thought of as, you know, steady and predictable, the rising and setting of the sun at predictable times was actually slightly in flux. Mm-hmm. That knowledge was really kind of scary to me, and I started to wonder right away what would happen if a much larger shift ever took place. Mm-hmm. And so I started writing a short story in which I imagined that. And so then eventually that story became this book, and instead of microseconds, the 24-hour day changes by hours, you know, so 25 hours, 26 hours, eventually 40 hours and longer.
Longer, right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's a fascinating premise because it allows basically the entire ecology of the Earth to have to adapt or die.
That's right. Yeah. So there's a lot of, plants and animals are affected. Birds fall from the sky, whales beach themselves. People have to figure out how to grow crops in this new world in which the nights have grown just, equally as the days grow, so do the nights. So there's less and less light in a row.
Can you read for us how this family discovers this happens right here? Start and stop?
Sure.
On a page.
My parents were spending that morning the way I remember them spending every morning, reading the newspaper at the dining room table. I can still see them sitting there, my mother in her green bathrobe, her hair wet, skimming quickly through the pages, while my father sat in silence, fully dressed, reading every story in the order it appeared, each one reflected in the thick lenses of his glasses. My father would save that day's paper for a long time afterward, packed away like an heirloom, folded neatly beside the newspaper from the day I was born. The pages of that Saturday's paper, printed before the news was out, report a rise in the city's real estate prices, the further erosion of several area beaches, and plans for a new freeway overpass. That week, a local surfer had been attacked by a great white shark. Border Patrol agents discovered a 3-mile-long drug-running tunnel 6 feet beneath the U.S.-Mexico border, and the body of a young girl, long missing, was found buried under a pile of white rocks in the wide, empty desert out east. The times of that day's sunrise and sunset appear in a chart on the back page, predictions that did not, of course, come to pass. Half an hour before we heard the news, my mother went out for bagels. I think the cats sensed the change before we did. They were both Siamese, but different breeds. Chloe was sleepy and feathery and sweet. Tony was her opposite, an old and anxious creature, possibly mentally ill, a cat who tore out his own fur in snatches and left it in piles around the house, tiny tumbleweeds set adrift on the carpet. In those last few minutes, as I ladled dry food into their bowls, the ears of both cats began to swivel wildly toward the front yard. Maybe they felt it somehow, a shift in the air. They both knew the sound of my mother's Volvo pulling into the driveway, but I wondered later if they recognized also the unusually quick spin of the wheels as she rushed to park the car, or the panic in the sharp crack of the parking brake as she yanked it into place. Soon, even I could detect the pitch of my mother's mood, from the stomps of her feet on the porch, the disorganized rattle of her keys against the door. She had heard those earliest news reports, now notorious, on the car radio between the bagel shop and home. "Turn on the TV right now," she said. She was breathless and sweaty. She left her keys in the teeth of the lock, where they would dangle all day. She went on, "Something god-awful is happening."
And what I like, you know, there's something, this is almost a science fiction, right? I mean, it's a future parallel universe.
It certainly kind of is. It certainly has a sort of science fiction-ish.
Right. But you never explain why. No one ever can figure it out why.
That's right. It's really, I wanted it to be a story about what it would be like to react and live with an event that we didn't see coming and which we couldn't immediately or even after a while figure out why it was happening or how far it would progress, which I think it was interesting to write about that. And I found that to be sort of analogous to ordinary life. Mm-hmm. You know, we never know what's around the corner. So none of us know the future, and that and to be able to write about a situation where that was heightened and more literal, mm-hmm. that question was really, you know, fascinating.
So we discover things little bit by little bit, hour by hour in the first part, and then day by day from the television, of course, and from other neighbors and who react in certain ways. And her best friend, tell us about her best friend, the Mormon family.
So Julia's best friend is named Hannah, and they've been very close. But then as a result of the slowing, you know, people react in different ways, especially in those first few days. There's a lot of panic, and her family, her friend Hannah's family, chooses to leave town and go to Utah, where they have relatives and also where a lot of Mormons are gathering in the book. Mm-hmm. But for Julia, so that's kind of this major change for her friend. But for Julia, that also means she's lost her best friend at this time, in this time that is, you know, maybe the most frightening time in her life. Suddenly, she's without her closest friend.
Right.
And so she feels kind of on her own from then on.
Now, sixth grade is a time when close friends are very important, as we probably all remember.
Right.
We'd like to have had one if we didn't. But they change, you know, that you can have a fight and never going to talk to them again type of thing. And she has a few other acquaintances from school who she then has to connect with in a little more, you know, strongly because there's no one else. Her mother has a reaction. Tell us a little bit about the illness.
So Julia's mother, from the beginning, I think she especially reacts in a way. She especially panics more than Julia's father, who reacts by trying to sort of keep everyone calm and sort of act as if the situation is not as serious as it is. But Julia's mother is naturally nervous in general, and this only heightens it. And that,
like the two cats,
right? and she gradually, as the situation gets worse and worse, she is one of the people who develops a mysterious syndrome, which it's unclear to scientists or to the people themselves exactly what's causing it, but it seems to be related to the slowing, whether it's has to do with sleep or circadian rhythms or something more mysterious, or possibly, as Julia's father suggests, maybe just the stress and the fear of going through such an kind of unimaginable change has caused her to sort of develop these strange symptoms, you know, mm-hmm. dizziness and mm-hmm. Fatigue and
But then lots
fainting.
Of other people yeah. have the exact same.
Yes. It's not everyone, but it's a widespread right. And mysterious illness.
Now, her father is an obstetrician.
Right.
So he's going to, you know, he's used to dealing with events that he can, you know, help out. And so he wants to do that with all those around him. And others in the neighborhood react in different ways. We have several families that something happens, the state, the government decides the way to handle this after a while is just to use the same old 24-hour clock and live as though the, you know, the nights weren't longer and the days weren't longer.
That's right. So that means just as a sort of measure against chaos, the state has decided to put people on clock time, as it becomes known. Even though that means that because the natural day no longer corresponds to the 24-hour day, that means that children are sometimes going to school in the dark, and people are often trying to sleep. You know, night occurs while the sun is shining, and whole days pass in darkness, whole nights pass in light. So as soon as I made that decision, I knew that there would be some people who would resist that kind of artificial or what would seem artificial clock type of living. Mm-hmm. And so there are a few people on Julia Street who decide, and certainly in the wider society, who decide to resist the clock resist that new clock time. And instead, try to live by the rising and setting of the sun.
Real timers.
Yes, they become known as real timers.
Right. Now, tell me the process that went through. Where did this idea come from that the government would impose this 24-hour rule?
You know, I just I wrote this story in order. You know, so oh. I was sort of finding out what would happen or figuring out what would happen as I went, but as the days got longer, I started to realize just how chaotic. I mean, the natural days got longer and longer, I started to realize pretty quickly how chaotic that would be, you mm-hmm. know, for schedules and work days and school days. So it just seemed obvious to me that the government would have to do something. And it seemed enforced. It's not an enforced rule. It's just that this is how it's going to be for public schools are going to be on the clock.
Right.
Corporations decide to be on the clock. So you really, if you decide not to live on that 24-hour clock, you're living outside of society in a way. But yeah, it seemed realistic to me that just in order to maintain some kind of order and maybe also to cling to our ordinary rituals, the government and most of society would return to the 24-hour clock, even though that there's a certain different kind of chaos that comes with that now that in this new changed world where the slowing.
Right. Now, one of the teachers assigns a math problem where they're supposed to figure out where how long the day will be, because it's about 20 minutes more a day. So how long the day will be in 3 months from now kind of thing. Did you have a little chart on the wall using the same kind of thoughts or to make sure that you were accurate? Because you know somebody's going to sit down and figure this out
right.
if they read the book.
I did have to have made charts and I was always keeping track of where I was with the day. And sometimes I had to – it was important to always know how long the days were so that if I wrote a scene that took place the night before and then the next day, if it was morning, I'd have to sort of check my charts to figure out would it be light or would it be dark. So there was a certain amount of figuring in that way.
Well, what I think you mentioned already, but I enjoyed the fact that you've got the regular terrors, if you will, of being a sixth grade girl specifically, and one of the things that's I don't know, everybody has to go through is the bullies. So can you read, this is about a page and a half. It's about a bully at a bus stop.
Right. As has been well documented, rates of murder and other violent crime spiked in the days and weeks following the start of the slowing. There was something in the atmosphere. It was as if the slowing had slowed our judgment too, letting loose our inhibitions. But I've always felt that it should have produced the opposite effect. This much is certainly true. After the slowing, every action required a little more force than it used to. The physics had changed. Take, for example, the slightly increased drag of a hand on a knife or a finger on a trigger. From then on, we all had a little more time to decide what not to do. And who knows how fast a second guess can travel? Who has ever measured the exact speed of regret? But the new gravity was not enough to overcome the pull of certain other forces, more powerful, less known. No law of physics can account for desire. I finally heard the bus rumbling I finally heard the bus rumbling around the corner toward us, its brakes squeaking, its engine rattling. Daryl heard it too. And that's when he grabbed hold of the front of my shirt and pulled up. I twisted away from him, but I was too late. Here's what I remember next. The white of my t-shirt over my face. The whoosh of damp air on my bare breastbone and bare ribs. Over the whole flat plane of my chest. The excited squeals of the other kids. As I turned, I saw Seth, his long limbs swinging as he walked, heading in our direction, just in time to see my bare chest. Daryl held me that way for a few long seconds while I twisted and turned. The two of us locked in a perverse dance. I could feel the cold air on my skin and the chain of my necklace digging into the back of my neck. Finally, Daryl let the edge of my shirt drop. "Liar," he said. "I knew you weren't wearing a bra." The bus stopped at the curb and began to idle there. The light, sweet smell of diesel filled the air. I felt faint. I was blinking back tears. "Jesus, Daryl," said Seth, coming up and shoving him in the shoulder. "What the hell?" Months later, Michaela's mother would spread a star chart before us and explain to me that the slowing had shifted everyone's astrological signs. Fortunes had changed. Personalities had rearranged. The unlucky had turned lucky. The lucky had turned less so. Our fates, so long written in the stars, had been rewritten in a day. "Don't worry," whispered Michaela as we climbed up the steps and onto the bus. "No one saw anything." But I knew that this was something you said when the exact opposite was true. Everyone saw everything.
Everyone saw everything. Be a sixth grader. There's a poignancy to that scene, you know, a universalism to it. Where'd that come from? Is this something that were you trying to make a statement there? There's three or four levels going on. You know, the person who's predicting how things have changed, the stars haven't changed, have they? They're still the same. Does that change astrology?
You know, when I read that, I was picturing that because of their calendar, the days have come sort of out of sync with the calendars that they used before, especially before they go on to clock time. So it affects our understanding of where we are, you know,
according to the calendar. It's not 28 days between anymore.
Right, exactly. Especially in this first year, because initially they try to stay on. They don't initially go to the 24-hour day, so they've sort of lost some days as a result. But that scene, you know, it's not something that happened to me, but just the feeling of what it's like to be an 11-year-old girl and the fear that something really upsetting and embarrassing could happen.
Because it will.
Yeah. And the feeling when you are 11, I think those things feel really important and upsetting, and there's something about it that when you're older, of course, something
they
like that wouldn't
feel
happen.
Important yeah. and upsetting, don't they? Yes.
Well, at least
we all have our recollections of sixth and seventh
right,
grade.
Right, right, right. But things that happen that are upsetting when you're an adult, I think it's just you have a little more perspective. And so I wanted to write a scene that would evoke those emotions that I remember of how self-conscious you can feel, especially as a young girl.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what you're telling me as how you wrote this is you didn't have a, you know, they always tell you, you're probably in your MFA program, they told you, oh, well, you have to have a beginning, middle, and end and chart it out and, you know, do all these things and put post-it notes up or however to keep track of the story arc, right? But you didn't have that.
Right. I mean, as I liked to know a little ways ahead of what was going to happen, but I didn't have a complete outline. And I think writers have to write in whatever way works for them, and you know, different ones. Some people use outlines and some people don't. But I think the value for me of not having it too carefully outlined ahead of time is that it keeps me as a writer more in tune with what the reader's experience of the story will be like, because the reader and I are in the exact same place. After I had written, you know, 70 pages, the reader and I knew the same amount
same
of information.
Right.
Right. So it was easier. For me, I find it useful to do it that way, at least with this book. We'll see if I always do that. But it was when it's possible, I think it's useful.
So did you create a backstory for these characters?
You mean things that happened before the
novel?
Yeah,
that's important in the to them.
You know, the way that I wrote it was that I sort of figured out who they were as I wrote and as I watched them. I mean, not in a mystical way, but as I figured out how they would respond to these changes, that helped me get to know them better. And so then the next time in some other situation, I would remember how I had the father respond to something, and I would use that to, you know, make sure it was consistent and yet maybe complicate it slightly in some later scene. Mm-hmm. So that
this is the secret they use for Casablanca, you know.
Oh, what's that?
They did not have the script done. They wrote it about a day ahead.
Well,
so no one who was playing knew how it was going to end, and no one who was writing knew how it was going to end. So there's this kind of, as you watch them on screen, next time you look at them,
yeah,
you'll see they're really not sure what the future's going to hold.
Wow, I didn't know that about that movie. I mean, if I was making a movie, that would be a little more of a frightening process, since you have all those
yes.
actors and stuff. But I do think there's something to it, because then everyone's on the same page.
Well,
as
there's
it were.
A freshness to it that I hadn't realized this is how you'd done it, but as I was reading, you know, it's there's a matter of factness. Okay, this is the way it is. Now I'm 11, and so mm-hmm. this is the world I know. You don't have that, you know, experience of age to say, well, when I was younger, you know, it was this way. When you say when I was six, it was this way, right?
Right, right.
So, and you bring in the grandfather as the older character who does a bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to get ready. We need to remember the past because you never know what tomorrow's going to bring, kind of thing. Which is there's an interesting part when she goes to visit the grandfather. In fact, I'd like you to read with us. Let's see. Grandfather's House, page 59. Because I love where you've put him. And it's the start is right here, my grandfather.
Okay.
Yep.
My grandfather lived in the middle of a luxury housing development. His old house was a holdout against the new surroundings. Once off the freeway, we drove through a network of fresh black streets, sliced at every corner by a shimmering white crosswalk. The stop signs were new. The speed bumps were new. Everything here was new. Curbs remained sharp and unscuffed. Fire hydrants stood gleaming and rust-free. Rows of saplings grew at evenly spaced intervals along the sidewalks, and the sidewalks literally sparkled. All the houses had lawns like thick heads of hair. Amid all this newness, my grandfather's dusty acre persisted, invisible, like a patch of dark matter. You could tell it existed from the way the roads curved around it, but you couldn't see it from the outside. You only sensed it. The developer of the neighboring community had planted thick pine trees on every side of my grandfather's lot so the neighbors could avoid looking at it. We drove through my grandfather's open wooden gate, where the smooth asphalt turned to chunky gravel beneath our tires, and the carefully planned green spaces of the development gave way to the region's natural landscape, scraggly and dry, barren and brown and unlovely. My father had grown up on this land in an age when there were chickens and horses here. But the last horse had long since died, and now the stable stood still. And now the stable stood like a relic of an ancient era. The wooden fence posts and cross pieces lay bleaching in the sun. The chicken coop was empty of chickens. My grandfather was 86 years old. All his friends were dead. His wife was dead. He had grown bitter about his own longevity. "Just hope you didn't inherit my genes, Julia," he said to me often. "It's a curse to live too long." I liked the way he always said exactly what he thought. Years earlier, the developers had tried to buy my grandfather's property, but he refused to sell it. "Damn it," he said, "I got things buried in this land." I knew that at least two cats had been interred out behind the woodpile, and I suspected that he had also buried certain other valuables over the years. The developers went ahead without him, laying roads and foundations around him, erecting houses and street signs on every side of his property. The new neighborhood rose up around my grandfather's land like floodwater surrounding high ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's almost that property is almost I don't know what you could call it, a bellwether of what's happening. Because each time that she goes to visit, the perfection surrounding that acre is crumbling.
Oh, that's very interesting. I hadn't quite thought of it in that that metaphorical way, but you're right. I like that idea. I like it, but it's true. It's true. And certainly he lives in this old house, in this old, he has a lot of old fashioned ways. But like you said before, he's remembering, you know, previous times of crisis that, Julia is obviously too young mm-hmm. to remember, but you know, the Cold War.
Is this 2012? Is the 86 in 2012?
Yeah, I wanted this book to feel in general as if, you know, what if tomorrow morning we wake up and this news were to hit? So
he's had major crises that he's lived through. Yeah.
Certainly, yeah.
He had the Great Depression. And
right.
I'm trying to remember if he'd be old or not. He's a little too young for the pandemic. You know,
right. Flu, but World War II and in the Cold War, it comes up later in the book.
Cuban Missile Crisis.
He's been through that. He has a bomb shelter actually from that time.
Right. Which is important.
Right. It becomes part of the book. Parcel. Yeah.
There's another architectural use of building. Well, actually, there's several as I think about it through the book, but I've highlighted certain ones that I just love the way they were written, and I want you to share. This one, this is kind of funny. I want you to come to here and then skip down to the floor so that you don't have to read that part.
Okay.
This is out in the, is this La Jolla? The mansions?
You know, I was picturing, in general, it's made up. I wanted to be able to,
not a specific house.
Well, I wanted to be able to take liberties, you know, with the setting and the house, you know, as needed, but.
I was trying to picture which house it was.
It reminded me of the beach in Del Mar is where I was sort of picturing.
That's a good one.
So
you're going to start here, and then you're just going to skip those two paragraphs and start again there at the floors. Okay.
Certain disasters evolved into attractions. My father and I sometimes drove down to the coast to look at what the ocean had done to the beachfront houses, evacuated since the slowing had mysteriously swelled the tides. At high tide, waves rolled across rooftops, the roof lines forming a geometric shoreline, while divers secretly scoured the insides for treasures. At low tide, those mansions dripped and creaked like sunken ships, exposed. They were magnificent houses, the homes of movie stars and millionaires. But the ocean had aged them at high speed. All the windows had been blown out and would someday wash up in pieces on the sand, bits of smooth sea glass mixing with the shells. The beaches had been closed since the start of the slowing, but my father liked to explore at low tide. Come on, he said one Sunday, when I hesitated in the driveway of an abandoned Caped Cod. Dozens of yards of police tape flapped in the wind. No one else was around. Even the seagulls were gone, the sickness having swept them all away. The house was enormous. Its shingles were warped from the water, and the front door was missing. Most of the contents had been flushed out by the waves. Everything inside was gray. One whole wall was missing. The living room faced out to the sea, like an open garage.
Let's take a break. It's a good time. You are listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org. We are talking with Karen Thompson-Walker about her debut novel, The Age of Miracles, and we'll follow with excerpts from a 2008 program with Point Reyes historian and environmentalist Philip L. Fradkin. Philip died recently at his home in Point Reyes Station, and the conversation was about his book, Wallace Stegner and the American West. So stay tuned for some more word-by-word conversations with writers right here on KRCB 91.1 FM. So we've just been and visited the house, and I want you to pick it up just a little bit later, because what happens right down there, yeah. And I think it's a really telling father-daughter story.
Okay. The floors were littered with driftwood and seaweed and glass. I was in this house once, years ago, said my father. He was squinting in the sunlight. I had noticed only recently how many wrinkles formed around his eyes when he smiled. I came to a Christmas party here once with an old girlfriend, he said. This was her parents' house. A foamy surge of water rushed into the room. We were instantly ankle deep. My sandals felt heavy under the weight of the cold water. Dad, please, I said, looking back down the hall. A layer of white water swirled over the hardwood floor. Two teenagers had recently drowned in just this way in one of the old houses farther up the coast. Can we go now? I said. There was a huge Christmas tree right here, said my father, motioning with two hands to indicate the width. He was almost yelling to be heard above the sound of the water, and a grand piano over there. We almost got married, that girl and I, he said. This was before I met your mother, of course. The water was getting higher with each new surge. A small plastic bottle was adrift in the room. Dad, I said, seriously. You'll see when you're older, he said. You won't believe how quickly the years will pass. I feel like I was just here, but it's been 20 years. The tide had risen to my calves. I felt the strong pull of the water against my skin, and it scared me. Can we please go now? I said. Okay, he said. All right, let's go. We waded together back through the house and out to the driveway. My father spotted a seagull as we climbed back up to the road. Look, he said, squinting. I hadn't seen a live one in weeks, and it did seem amazing in that moment that there had ever existed a creature with the power to fly. My jeans were sticking to my thighs. The whole car stank of salt water. You used to be much braver, you know, said my father as he started the engine. You really did, he said. You're getting to be as bad as your mother. And he was right. I had grown into a worrier, a girl on constant guard for catastrophes large and small, for the disappointments I now sensed were hidden all around us, right in plain sight.
That was Karen Thompson-Walker reading from The Age of Miracles, a very interesting chapter about a father and daughter who go and visit the houses that are being swallowed back by the sea. In a time when the days are and nights are getting longer and longer and longer, for no reason that we know. Now, also, of course, what's happening here is I realize that this is a coming-of-age novel.
Right, right.
And there's a term that I just heard recently means formation novel in German called Bildungsroman. Is that it? Something
yeah.
like that?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the psychological and moral growth of a protagonist from youth to adulthood, in which character's change is extremely important. And that's what's happening in this chapter. We're defining that. And the father's aware of it, the daughter's aware of it. And the line, you're acting more and more like your mother, is not a positive thing.
Right. No, especially because when he says that, his relationship with his wife, you know, with Julia's mother, is at a particular point of strain, too. So I think he's disappointed seeing Julia take on some of the habits that bother him about his wife.
Mm-hmm.
So But yeah, I think that in general, there's a time in childhood, and specifically for Julia, where she's noticing the flaws in her parents, and in a way, in this scene, the father seems to be sort of suggesting that he's noticing flaws in her, which I thought was kind of a sad but maybe true to life moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of the most intimate moments the father and daughter have.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
They talk each other like, you know, they're buddies and they're friends, and they, you know, they love each other, but that doesn't mean you can't be a little critical.
Right, and that they're not connecting the way that each wishes they could.
Right. Is this because of what's happening on a daily basis, or just what's happening in their ordinary lives?
Well, I think that the question of what the things that happened to Julia, what are results of the slowing and all the stress that surrounds it, and what instead are just the ordinary catastrophes of daily life, that's a question that haunts Julia. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in exploring that. You know, certainly, I think some version of this disconnect between father and daughter was on its way into their lives and is just a natural part of growing up. But then, you know, all of those ordinary things are heightened in the book by this extreme situation that everyone is facing.
Right. Well, one of the things the father does to help, he thinks, is to offer a talisman. Remember that, you know, the old Joseph Campbell, you know, have to have a certain sequence of events for the mythic hero, who she is. And the talisman is a telescope. Now, that allows her to, of course, look at the stars and see any changes, which may not actually be changed because the world's still going around and the stars
right.
are still in the sky, although they may be there at different times of the year now. But she also looks at her neighbors.
That's right.
And she sees things going on in the dark and the light, which otherwise she wouldn't be aware of. And one of them, do you mind reading this section? You
sure.
See what it is and see if you want your readers to know about this before they pick up the book.
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to read it. It does give away.
I know. Well, so don't listen if you don't want to hear a spoiler, right?
Okay. Sylvia's curtains were closed except...
Say who Sylvia. We haven't met Sylvia before, so we should.
That's right. Yeah, so Sylvia lives across the street from Julia and her family. And she is Julia's piano teacher. And the other thing about her is that she becomes one of the people who resists the clock and decides instead to live on, you know, natural time, real time, as it becomes known, which means she tries to live her life by the rising and the setting of the sun. So she tries to sleep when it's dark, stays awake when it's light, even though those things are lasting much longer than they do in our real world now, you know, night and day are so much
right.
longer.
And one important point is that the girl can look right into Sylvia's bedroom window with her telescope.
That's right. Sylvia's curtains were closed except for a sliver. With my telescope, I could see through the crack that she was in there. She was a swishing skirt, an open mouth, a streak of strawberry hair gliding past the window. For once, she was not alone. A man's arm swung quickly into view, his sleeve rolled up to the elbow. I watched as he lowered a glittery silver star onto the top of the tree. The man curled his arm around Sylvia's slim waist. They kissed a quick kiss. I was relieved to see her smile. Outside, Sylvia's car sat alone in the driveway, as if this man had come from nowhere, simply appeared in her living room by some magical means. I watched for a moment longer. And then it happened. I realized as he turned that I knew that man's mouth. I knew the sharp slope of his jaw, the long angle of his hairline. I recognized that blue shirt. I remembered exactly how it had looked when it was brand new on Father's Day at the steakhouse. The shirt starched flat and folded in a silver department store box, topped with a purple card, handmade by me.
Mm-hmm. So, should we call it romance continues even if the world is changing, or maybe because of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think ordinary life continues, and
right.
ordinary life includes,
right.
you know,
finding
love
out,
and yeah.
finding out about secrets.
Finding
know.
Out about secrets,
right.
but also falling in love, falling out of love, all those ordinary things definitely go on in this book, and especially because the catastrophe in my novel unfolds at a slower rate than some kinds of catastrophe.
Well, and
would.
Then here it's significantly changed. I mean, that's basically the first part, you know, majority of the book takes place in that 1 year.
Yes, that's right. No, there's certainly a lot of changes, but there's enough. Ordinary life, it is possible for a certain amount of ordinary life to go on, so a young girl can still, you know, look through a telescope outside her bedroom window and see something she shouldn't see in the house across the street. But I think the question of whether it would have happened, this thing between her father and Sylvia would have happened without the slowing, is a question that, like I said, haunts Julia and is also kind of unknowable in the same way that those things are unknowable in our own lives.
Yeah, one of the things I did is I read the whole book from, you know, beginning to end, and then I went back. This is what I do. And then I go back and remember the scenes that were strong. And I say, so what I did is I caught the clues that you'd laid down. See, I didn't know you wrote it the way you'd written it. I figured you were very cleverly saying, okay, well, I have to have this little clue here in chapter 2 because it's going to set up chapter 18.
Right.
And it's there. And you wonder, it makes you wonder if there was something going on before this change occurred with the piano teacher, you know, basically neighbor.
Right.
Who is, and a wife who is becoming less appealing.
Yeah, and I think Julia's mother is becoming a source of stress, right, for her father,
right,
also, rather than a source of any sort of comfort, because she is so worried about what's going to happen to all of them.
Well, the conversation at the house about, you know, this was before I met your mother.
Right.
I could have, you can see the mind go, well, it could have been a different, life could have been different.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Which in that type, you know, maybe Julia's father would have had those feelings, whether the slowing happened or not.
Right.
Just that wondering.
I think he would.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing – well, there is something that has a tremendous impact that I don't want to discuss here, and I'm not going to have you read. But it's an accident that, you know, brings something tragic to their lives and really affects them in, you know, profound ways, but not – direct ways. Do you know
right.
what I mean?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
I hope that gets everybody's interest. it's a fascinating book. You have, of course, you know, love goes on too, because the 11-year-old who's turning 12 has a birthday party, and they have a strange rite of passage that's happening here. Let's see what chapter that is. Dance parties. Okay, you know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
So let's read a little bit from there. Here you go. I love how you read, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much.
I know
much.
I'm just throwing you things, and this is kind of,
it's fun. It's fun to look back at some of the sections I haven't looked at in a while. So
all right,
it's fun. So this is the opening of a chapter. But no force on earth could slow the forward march of sixth grade.
Okay, say that again. I love that line.
But no force on earth could slow the forward march of sixth grade. And so, in spite of everything, that year was also the year of the dance party. Whenever the birthday of one of my classmates rolled around, invitations were mailed to a select list of boys as well as girls. Gone were the days of single-sex parties. Now DJs were hired and dance floors rented. Strobe lights and disco balls were strung from the ceilings of basements or from backyard fences, or, in the case of Amanda Cohen, from the eaves of a cavernous hotel ballroom. Michaela used to describe these festivities to me while we waited for the school bus on certain mornings. But sometimes I didn't need to be told. On one particular Monday, all the prettiest girls showed up at school zipped snugly into matching pink sweatshirts with Justine Valero's name and birthdate spelled out in rhinestones on the back, favors from the previous Saturday's party. I know that it was considered good fortune for a birthday to land on a dark night, the romance upped considerably by the moonlight and the stars. But as for the precise goings-on of these events, I couldn't say. I was never invited. I'm sure Justine just forgot to invite you, said Michaela. A brand new set of feathery red bangs dangled above Michaela's eyelids. She probably just forgot. Hannah was leaning against the fence nearby in a mint green sweater set and a blonde French braid. She laughed into her cell phone. We hadn't spoken in weeks. Besides, Michaela added, you wouldn't have fun anyway. You're too shy. I bet you'd just stand in the corner. That's not true, I said. I would dance. My own birthday was only a few weeks away. There would be no party. There would be no dancing. You'd dance, said Michaela. Really? It was dark that morning, the air wet with fog, which glowed around the streetlights as it rolled up over the lip of the canyon, where, like everywhere else, dozens of native plant species were slowly dying from insufficient light. I danced with Seth Moreno on Saturday for like an hour, Michaela continued. Seth's name flared in my head. He was there? I asked. He's super hot up close, she said. She shivered in her miniskirt. I could feel his thing. Right then, Seth pulled up to the bus stop on his skateboard, and Michaela stopped talking.
Now, tell us a bit about Seth.
Seth is a young boy that Julia sort of has a crush on, has been interested in before the slowing. And he is kind of quiet, kind of a loner, but not in a, you know, creepy way, but in a, to Julia, makes it his isolation makes him interesting to her. And he is a skateboarder, and his mother is very sick and has been sick for years. So Julia sees in Seth someone who seems to be, or at least she imagines, he seems to be kind of aware of a certain kind of sadness in life.
A little wounded.
Yes. Yeah. And Julia, I think that she finds that sort of it's appealing to her to try to learn more about him and get to know him, and she finds it, I think, moving that he is going through something so big. And he also, in the same way that she becomes increasingly isolated, he sort of isolates himself. So she has been watching him from afar. Mm-hmm. And then at a certain point in the book begins to get to know him a little better.
Because of the whales.
Right.
Where he, out of the blue, says, you know, the whales have beached themselves. You want to go down the beach with me?
Right. So the slowing has – that's one of the consequences of the slowing. And he invites her to go with him one day to go look at the whales.
Right.
And it's
– And hold hands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's – I think it was it's a moment where I think I wanted to suggest that maybe he was more curious about Julia than she would have ever known, you know, that he would invite her. And but I liked the moment when they go see the whales. Is also – it's one of my favorite moments in the book, because it really brings together the, you know, the planetary consequences, the ecological consequences of this giant global catastrophe, but with the meaning of ordinary life among young people. You know, here's two young people spending an afternoon together and feeling – and they're feeling really moved and devastated by what's happening around them, but they're still two young people, you know, mm-hmm. having a little mm-hmm. adventure. So I liked whenever I could write about both of the pieces of the book at the same time. It was really satisfying to me.
Right. So how have people reacted as you talked your book up around the country?
You know, I mean, people have been very nice. It's been a little, it's been, the whole experience has been like a roller coaster ride in a good way. You know, there's people, it's been exciting to see people respond to the book, and of various ages. And it's still, for me as a new author, it's still just exciting that anyone besides, you know, me and my husband are reading the book. So I hope to always hold on to that, because
okay.
It's very exciting.
Well, I can understand that. I can't tell because I've got an advanced copy, but I didn't know how they classified this, you know, on the back of the book, so that the booksellers know where to put things on the shelf. Is this a YA novel?
No, it's published as an adult novel,
right.
And I definitely wrote it. The way I write is I like to try to imagine what I myself would want to read. So, you know, that's what I was picturing as I wrote the book. And I love to read books about childhood and about adolescence, especially when the narrator is actually an adult, so that you have access to, you know, in my book, it's Julia as an adult looking back in very close detail mm-hmm. on her childhood. But that way you have access both to the intensity of childhood, but also a little bit of remove and wisdom and perspective of the adult.
Yeah.
So I wrote it with adults in mind, but it's been very exciting. to hear that younger readers are interested, and I'm kind of looking forward to hearing from them to see how authentic they think the portrayal of an 11-year-old is.
Well, I imagine you remembered your 11-year-old experiences and elaborated on those, and and maybe know some people that age, relatives or friends who were kids or something.
Yeah, mostly I was drawing on my own memories of that age. Which
did they have the parties with the people wearing the pink? Hoodies and stuff.
There was a year when all of a sudden the kids started having dance parties, and it seemed to happen overnight. I think I made up the part about the sweatshirts, but the feeling of, you know, and unlike Julia, I was invited to some of them and not to others. But in Julia's case, she really is left out completely. Mm-hmm. But I do remember that feeling of how important it seemed at that young age, you know, because even though these are small things, clicks and who's getting invited to what party, it still comes down to whether you feel, you know, liked and loved, which is, you know, not something that desire to feel appreciated and to feel like you connect with other people is not something we ever outgrow.
Right.
So that's the beginning of it, though.
Got two other questions for you. One is, Kate Medina does a letter. Is that going to be in every book? Oh, just in ours.
That's in the advance copies,
not in everybody's. Yeah. It's very nice. It says, when I first read Karen Thompson Walker's debut novel, I could not sleep. So excited I was at discovering. This is Kate Medina, who most people don't know, but she's the executive vice president of Random House and the editorial director. I met her at a conference once, a very powerful woman. And that she took this novel under her wing, so to speak, or whatever you want to call it, certainly is a kudo to you.
Yeah, it was very exciting. I feel very lucky that I landed with Kate, and she is just an amazing editor, really insightful,
the
really
old
thorough
style of editing.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, yeah, she does. She really likes to get involved with the pages and the sentences, and I'm really thankful that I worked with her. And it's clear to me why she has such a great reputation, you know, after working with
her.
Right,
right. Now, one other thing is, I always like to ask people this, is for the writers who want to write, mm-hmm. who are listening, do you have any advice?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think my advice, I mean, number one is to not try to get something published if you yourself could still make it better, because it's just so hard to get anything published that if you think, you know, if you really think about it, you feel like a few more months of work or a few years of work would make it better, that's going to increase your chances, you know. But at the same time, you have to be prepared for a lot of the possibility of bad luck. And so in that sense, I think just being patient and determined are really the only things you can do. And to always stay focused on the writing. And, the better you get at your writing, the better chance you'll have.
Don't send off your first draft.
Right. That's right. Right. Exactly.
Okay. I guess I got one more question. Okay. What's your next project?
Well, I'm in the early stages of writing a new novel, and I feel a little superstitious about saying too much about it.
Don't have
but
to. Don't do it then.
It's an extreme situation.
Cross
again.
Your fingers.
It's an extreme situation, which there's something I find inspiring about writing about people facing something extreme.
Well, I want to thank you again. This is Karen Thompson Walker's new novel, The Age of Miracles. And it doesn't matter if you're a young adult or an old adult. I think you'll really enjoy this. It's the ordinary and the everyday in an unusual situation of time and space. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Word by Word on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org. Where tonight's conversation has been with Karen Thompson Walker about her coming of the age at the end of the world novel, The Age of Miracles. Next, we are honoring historian and environmentalist Philip L. Fradkin, who died recently at his Point Reyes Station home. Philip Fradkin's obituary in the LA Times reads, "Philip Fradkin, a native New Yorker whose fascination with the West turned him into an astute chronicler of the region's history and environmental legacy in books on such topics as the Great San Francisco Earthquake, nuclear test fallout in Nevada, and the survival of the Colorado River, died Saturday at his home in Point Reyes Station. He was 77. Philip Fradkin had a conversation with Gil Manser on Word by Word in the Spring 2008 program, focusing on Fradkin's Wallace Stegner and the American West. As listeners know, we often like to ask our Word by Word guests to share advice about the writing process.
In honor of Phil Fradkin, here is what Wallace Degner, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for his novel Angle of Repose, had to say about his journey to becoming a writer. This excerpt is from 1991 from the Academy of Achievement's Museum of Living History Audio Library, which is available free at iTunes U. Here is Wallace Degner on writing in his own words.
You have no notion that you can be a writer, though you know you like words and you like books. Your teachers tell you your themes are okay. People encourage you. You say something and somebody raises his ears and you try to do it again. But it never occurred to me that you could be a writer. I never saw a writer until I was past 21, I don't suppose. One in the flesh. Those were things that happened far off and long ago. I got to be a writer simply by accident, by pure inadvertence, by being pushed someplace by teachers. Nobody in my family had ever gone past the eighth grade in school. So I wind up with a PhD and I practice writing and I go east to teach. Well, first I teach at Utah, then at Wisconsin, then at Harvard. And finally, when I go back, I am aware of my abysmal lacks because I had belonged to nothing. I had no history, no tradition, no anything. I began to read history in order to find out where I belong because it had about occurred to me by then that I was one of those people that Wendell Berry, one of my former students, speaks of when he says, if you don't know where you are, you don't know who you are. I began to investigate the West that I had grown up in, read its history, look at its conditions. And those conditions and that history told me that that part of the world had not been settled properly. It had been raided. It had not been married. It had been raped. I got interested in trying to see what could be done about recording some of its history, even writing some of its history. And in saving some of the country that I had grown up in and loved, which was being devastated at a considerable pace. So I find myself eventually, to find out who I was, trying to locate myself in space and time, and becoming almost a professional Westerner, I suppose, because that was what I knew, and that was what I also needed to know. I had to find out who I was and where I was before I could be anything, before I could really write any books. Once you got to that point, and you may not have to go through all that preliminary, I hope you don't, you can let your talent manifest itself as it will, because it will. It can't be kept down. I often told students that if they could be discouraged, they should be. And if you can't be discouraged, then you're going to make it, probably, because that will be a sign that you're on your way. After that, the whole job is to see it truthfully, to see it as accurately as you possibly can, and to put it down and to keep on loving it, warts and all. That's the way I love this country, I guess, warts and all. And I work on the warts. That's, I think, all I have to say. Thank you.
That was Wallace Degner talking about becoming a writer who inspired the late Philip Fradkin to write the biography Wallace Stegner and the American West. You have been listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org. Tonight's guest was Karen Thompson Walker, talking about and reading from her novel, The Age of Miracles. Our studio engineer has been Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. We invite you to join us at 7 o'clock Wednesday, September 5th, for the next Word by Word right here on KRCB 91.1 FM, when our conversation will be with several writers featured at this year's Sonoma County Book Festival. Until then, we want you to stay cool and safe during the upcoming hot August nights.